we need to make sure that we're understanding not only the future of cybercrime, but the future of society and technology, because they're all very much interlinked. Cybercrime's never going to go away because crime is never going to go away. It's just another aspect of global crime. And the more that we as organizations and individuals are connected and digitally enabled, the more opportunities will present themselves for digital crime.
You're listening to KBCast, the cybersecurity podcast for all executives. Cutting through the jargon and hype to understand the landscape where risk and technology meet. Now, here's your host, Carissa Breen.
Hey everyone, it's KB. Thank you for being an active listener on the show. And thanks to you, we've been downloaded in 63 countries. If you haven't already, please ensure that you follow and subscribe to the show for the latest updates. Now, time to get to the interview. Joining me today is Rick Ferguson, VP of Security Intelligence from Forescout. And today we're discussing, why do hackers really hack? Rick, thanks for joining. It's absolutely wonderful to have you here. I have been following you for like a number of years, so I'm actually like a big fan of yours. So I'm actually really excited to interview you today.
Thank you. You know, in typical, I don't know if it's typical British style or typical Ferguson style, I never have any idea what to say when someone says something like that, but thank you.
I think that's exactly what you say. So thank you so much for joining. I'm excited to start getting into the interview because, you know, I've been, you know, following you for a while. I think we are connected on LinkedIn, and I've been, you know, watching some of your other interviews you've done in the past. So I know that this will be an interesting topic. So I want to start with, you've been a researcher for a very long time, and I'm curious to know, just maybe from your perspective, like, why do hackers really hack? Now, it sounds obvious, but I know that you're going to have some really interesting insights.
So I think, first of all, there's a really important distinction to draw between hackers and cyber criminals. And I think it's important that we say that straight out. I know it's difficult to control language. It's like pushing water uphill. But there is a very different moral distinction and ethical distinction between hackers and cyber criminals. So in order to answer your direct question directly, why do hackers hack? Because they want to find out how things work and they want to make them better. Hackers are the good guys. I would consider myself a hacker, and so would very many of my peers and colleagues online. We like to take stuff apart, whether that's something physical or whether that's something mental or emotional or whether that's a process. Find out how it works, why it works, find out how it could be subverted and misused, and then what we need to do to improve it and make it better and then put it back together again. That's why hackers hack. Why do people get involved in online crime? I think the answers are manifold and a lot less simple than why do hackers hack. Sometimes it's sheer boredom. It's always a progressive process. It's not like you leave school and you say, you know what, I'm going to be a cyber criminal. I think that's a very, very rare outcome. But we live in a world that is, I was going to say increasingly connected, but it's a world that is connected 24/7. I think, you know, we're all part of that. So kids growing up now are connected before they go to school, at home, and at work. We're also in a society which is much more socially networked, and where unfortunately we see malicious behavior in what they call expressive crimes. Expressive crimes are crimes based on the victim's emotional response, so provoking anger or a desire to cause harm to the victim emotionally. So we see a lot of trolling and a lot of unethical online behavior on social networks, which I think leads people to a belief that there's a distance or an unreality between themselves and their chosen victim. I don't think very often in those kinds of cases, like trolling and hate crimes online, that people really see the human that is their victim. They just see their chosen victim. And I think that disassociation extends into cybercrime as well. For a very long time, and I was listening recently to an interview with a guy who used to be a very prominent, very important Russian carder. So he was involved in credit card fraud, very deeply involved in some of the biggest markets and actually some of the biggest cyber crimes that several years ago. And he believed initially that it was a victimless crime, that, you know, if they stole money from somebody's bank account, then the bank would put the money back so that person wouldn't suffer. Then the bank would go to the insurance company, so the insurance company would reimburse the bank. And then whatever, the Bank of England would print some more money and everything would be fine. And it's a victimless crime. Of course, we know that that's not the truth, but that's what this attacker believed. So I think that thought that you can carry out crime online, but it's not the same as physical crime in the real world, definitely adds to the accessibility, if you like, of cybercrime.
Okay, that's super interesting. So yes, you are right in terms of the disassociation. So I historically worked in a bank in security, and you know, there were people like calling up saying, oh, I had all this money siphoned out of my account, like large amounts that we'd have to go and investigate, for example. And I think it's that, like, if you're like physically taking, like, I don't know, $50,000 from someone, maybe a bit harder than, oh, you know, I just siphoned out of a bank and the bank's going to pay them back. So would you say that there's that element of, we can't, you mentioned it before, you can't see the human. So it's like, oh, well, can't really see it. Can't really see I've just stolen 50K from Rick Ferguson, and, you know, who cares about his life and who cares about how he feels. But maybe it's a little bit different when you're physically there with someone. It may be a little bit harder for a crime to commit.
Yeah, it's absolutely that. I mean, like I say, this particular guy, and I think it's a very prevalent perspective, honestly believed, and I'm not saying that it justifies his actions at all, but he honestly believed it was a victimless crime, that everybody along the chain of people who were stolen from would get reimbursed up to the point where effectively all the Bank of England has to do, or the Bank of Australia or whatever, is print some new money and off we go, you know, and no one gets hurt. It's, and I think another important route into cybercrime also is desperation. And that's always been the case, in that people either have been well educated but don't see a means to make a decent living with their education, which I think was definitely used to be the case in Russia and the former CIS countries. That's why we saw a lot of criminality coming from Russia, from Ukraine, from Georgia, from that region, from Romania as well, because people were getting a good education, but they weren't getting historically the chance to use that education to make a decent salary, whereas cybercrime was relatively easy to get started in and offered the promise of significant sums of money. So from one side, there's desperation of, hey, I just can't get a decent job. But there's also, I can't get a job at all and I can't take care of my family, and criminals prey on that. So very often you will see what look like job advertisements. You may have even seen some come into your own email account. I know I have, but also on freelancer boards online, those kinds of places, looking for people, for example, to process financial transactions from the comfort of their own home. So you don't have to go to an office. We're going to transfer some money to your bank account. You take 90% of that money and transfer it somewhere else, and you keep 10%, and that's your job. But of course, what you're doing then is that's your first step into the world of cybercrime. You're acting as a money mule, helping online criminals to launder funds. So that kind of step-by-step route into cybercrime is common as well, going from doing things like sharing or selling counterfeit software on closed forums to slowly getting involved more in the financial or identity theft worlds of cybercrime.
Okay, so there's a couple of things in that which actually sort of leads me into my next question. So I was watching a movie the other day. Now, I know it's a movie, but it kind of like was pretty realistic. It's called Emily the Criminal. And basically, yeah, the story is that, I don't want to ruin it for anyone, but she's struggling to pay her debt. Like, she's working at some like catering place, and then the guy she was working with was like, oh, like, pull this number up and then you just go and see them. You can probably make some money. So she goes in, and it's sort of what you explained before. It's not like it's quite clear in how like you make the money. And then basically she gets involved with like credit card, you know, scamming. And then like she was like, no, I can't do this. And then obviously she gets into it, and then she gets into it more. So I'm just curious, like, would you say that this is a real life scenario, like how people fall into this type of work? I mean, I know that you mentioned it before, but would you say this is probably more the case on how people get into cybercrime initially?
It's definitely a real world scenario. I can talk about a friend of mine who got into cybercrime, but who fell victim to it. She had logged into her online banking. She wanted to transfer, say for the sake of argument, she wanted to transfer 50 euros to her mother. And she logged in through her browser, logged into the bank, everything looks fine. She made the transfer, She got the second factor code on her app on her phone, put the code in, and everything worked fine. In her browser, it looked like everything worked fine. And then later on that day, she got a call from her mom saying, "Hey, are you going to transfer that money? Because I could really do with it like today." And she said, "Yeah, I did it. I'll go and check." By now, she left home and she's at work. So she's logging into online banking through a different browser. Turns out her home PC was compromised, was infected. So her browser wasn't telling her the truth at home. When she logged in through her browser at work, she could see that actually she hadn't transferred 50 euros to her mum. She transferred 500 euros to an account that she'd never heard of before because her browser had been compromised. So where she thinks she's talking directly to the bank, there's a man in the middle. There's an attacker in the middle who's changing her requests, but using all of her authentication codes to make things happen. Now, the transfer happened. So, of course, she went straight to the bank. She alerted the bank. She alerted the police. And they managed to have the police standing by at the bank where this lady was coming to withdraw the cash. Because very often, the next step in money laundering is there's a transfer that has to take place. Then you withdraw the cash from the banking system and turn it into something like a wire transfer to try and make it less traceable or untraceable. So this lady had gone to the bank. She had had to take her son with her because she was using her son's account for this quote-unquote work that she was doing. And the police were there to arrest them. And she had been, so she was of Russian extraction, and she had been drawn in by advertisements on a job board because she was in desperate financial straits. It's effectively exactly that story. Luckily for her, that was her first transaction. She was caught early, and obviously, you know, she was dealt with through the justice system, but it didn't go any further. Very often, if people are not caught early, not only do they continue the money mule activity, the money muling, but they will be drawn slowly into further crimes and other acts of crime. I mean, Emily the Criminal, of course, it's a movie, so there are Hollywood elements to it. But the premise of it, I would say, is very accurate.
Yeah, okay. Wow, that's super interesting. So would you say that this is becoming more prevalent now because of how the world works and, like you were sort of mentioning before, like there's all these like job advertisements like trying to say like, oh, you can make money from home and all of these things that are probably attracting all different types of people where it's like, you know, now with everything going on in the world, like if people can get a job from home, like they're probably going to opt for that rather than, oh, I've got to go to the office 5 days a week and all of that type of thing. So would you say that people are just accidentally falling into it, or do you think it's more intentional? Like if you had to weight it, what would you sort of say?
I think initially it is accidental. I mean, we all view the world from the perspective that we understand. So it's easy for me to be cynical and say, how could you not know? You look at that advertisement, you look at the activity that you're actually carrying out. How could you not know that that was crime? But we have to remember to consider the world from the perspective of as many other people as possible. I've been working in the industry of cybercrime and cybercrime research for a very long time. So I view the world from that perspective. But, you know, if I were to consider it maybe from my mom's perspective, or you know, my friend who just really likes to go fishing, they would be not suspicious about opportunities like this. They would say, okay, well, we're in a work from home world now. This is how it works. So of course there are opportunities for freelancers to get a gig in this way. And one of the great skills that cyber criminals have is social engineering. And social engineering is just playing on people's emotions, getting them to do or say or accept things that they otherwise wouldn't do or say or accept. That's exactly how phishing works. That's exactly how you persuade someone to give up their password over the phone. That's exactly how you persuade a telephone company to transfer a SIM from someone else's phone to the criminal's phone. Social engineering is a very important and very widely used skill that attackers have. So persuading people into this kind of employment is just another use for that skill.
Totally get that. So would you also say, Rick, that just say, I don't know, Joanne working from home probably wasn't aware that she was getting involved in, you know, money muling, for example, and then she sort of works out like, oh, actually I'm doing that. Do you think that people are like, oh, well, I'm so far in now, it's going to keep going? Or do you think people are, oh, actually what I'm doing is wrong, against the law? Do you think people sort of back out, or like how does that sort of look? Because I understand that there are different reasons as to why like people get into it. Like you mentioned before, like people are desperate for money or they accidentally fall into it. But then once they know that they're in it, do you think that they are just sort of addicted to it's so easy to make this money from home and I don't really have to do anything much to make this type of money?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things at play. I think number one, if and when people come to this realization, they will also come to the realization that they are working for criminals. So there will be an element of fear at this point. Like, okay, what do I do now? They know who I am. They know where I am. They have my bank account details. They may know more than that depending on interactions you've had with them. So there will certainly be an element of fear which will keep you in that employ. There's also an element of fear of coming clean as well. We all know, I'm sure we all know, you've done something wrong. It's actually a really brave decision to go and tell whoever was affected that you did it. You know, that's something that we have since childhood. I look at my four-year-old daughter now and getting her to tell the truth that she broke something or whatever is really hard because there's an element of fear of coming clean, particularly if you're coming clean to the law. But you've got to understand if you are involved even peripherally in the world of cybercrime, it's better to get out before you get deeper in. The penalties will be significantly less, particularly if you're cooperating with law enforcement. What you've got to remember is the reason why criminals are recruiting people, unknowing people, to the role of money mule is that it's one of the riskiest operations in cybercrime. You are the most likely person to get caught. You are doing the traceable, trackable financial operations with real bank accounts. The law enforcement will find you and will arrest you. And if you're not cooperating or have been doing it for a significant period of time, the penalties will be worse.
Yeah, most definitely. Absolutely right. So there's another scenario I'm curious to get your thoughts on as well. Now, I think maybe you may have listened to the same podcast. So the Wall Street Journal produced a podcast called like, Hack Me If You Can. So Russian hacker Dmitry describes the way they produce this podcast was absolutely amazing. But he describes like how he got into stealing credit cards from American companies. And I think in 2008, he and his crew then pulled off one of the biggest hacks in history, credit card scam. So now this is a real example of how like people fall into it. I think it was he was trying to pay his car debt off and then somehow he fell into it and then it was just so, involved in it. And then I remember him sort of saying like, I'm just so far into this now, it's too hard. And the money was just so good that like, why would I go out and get a job? So I'm really keen to sort of find out like, is there more of this that's going to start happening now? Like, does it worry you because you've been a researcher for a long time? Like, have you seen like a massive increase in this? Like, this is another real life example of whether it's a loan, like a school debt, or it's a, I can't pay my car off or whatever it is, that now we're going to see more and more people getting involved in this type of crime?
Well, certainly, the guy Dmitry in the Wall Street Journal podcast you referenced, that was in the relatively early days of online crime, and crime was focused on carding. And actually, that kind of crime, particularly the cashing out aspect, using those stolen cards to make money, carried a certain amount of risk. You've got to make fraudulent purchases. What we're seeing now is with the prevalence of ransomware as an attack vehicle, that criminal groups are focusing very much on making ransomware easy to use, easy to distribute, and highly effective. And this really is attracting beginners into the market. There's a whole as-a-service economy that's grown up now within cybercrime. So we see, for example, people that are called initial access brokers or initial access vendors. They will break into an organization, but they won't actually do anything other than establish a presence. And then they will sell access to that organization, just access, for other people to commit further crimes. So they're kind of removing themselves from the real crime that's taking place, the further crime that's taking place. And we also see ransomware as a service. So criminal groups create the ransomware, the code that's going to do the encryption, and then they recruit what they call affiliates. And these affiliates will pay to become an affiliate of the ransomware gang, and then they will give up a percentage of any ransom that they successfully achieve to the ransomware gang, which means, again, that the threat actor themselves, the ransomware operation, don't necessarily have to do any breaking into organizations, any encrypting, any extortion. any receipt of funds from a victim organization, they're going to receive their funds from their affiliates who are committing the crimes on their behalf. But they focus very strongly on making sure that their product, the ransomware, is extremely easy to use, extremely easy to distribute, and is of the best quality because they're effectively competing against other ransomware operations and attracting through online forums, attracting relatively inexperienced people into the world of cybercrime. And the money can be huge. You know, you've only got to look at the case of Lapsus, who, you know, basically a large number of people within the Lapsus group were school kids. You've only got to look at the amount of money that is made by ransomware gangs. My former colleagues at Trend Micro released some mocked up accounts for the Conti ransomware operation in 2021, mocked up accounts for the year of 2021, that said this was an affiliate operation. And they used a lot of open source information, including all the Conti chat logs that had been hacked and released online. And they came up with a figure of $54 million in profit for the Conti group. So that's after they've met all the costs of development and testing of software, after they've paid off all their affiliates and met all the other infrastructure costs, for example, of being a ransomware operation, they still made $54 million in profit in 2021. So the lure of funds is huge and is real.
So do you think that's just going to keep increasing now? I mean, that's a fair bit.
And that's just one ransomware operation. So yeah, that's a fair bit, but it's only one gang. And actually it's one gang that's gone away and being replaced by others right now. The group people who were Conti have kind of spread into other groups like Black Bastard and Karakurt and a whole bunch of others. Royal ransomware. So ransomware has a very long history. It dates all the way back to the five and a quarter inch floppy disk back in the 80s. And the first ever ransomware was created by a medical professional, actually, called Dr. Joseph L. Popp. And he was supposedly he was a bit disgruntled that he'd been turned down for a job at the World Health Organization. And he sent out ransomware on floppy disks to a lot of hospitals and medical institutions. It wasn't encrypting ransomware like we know today. It masqueraded as a questionnaire that was supposed to judge your potential exposure to the AIDS virus. So it's become known as the AIDS Trojan, this very first ransomware. But after a period of time, it changed all the file extensions on your system and popped up a ransom note, said, hey, you have been using this application, but you haven't paid the license fee. Please send cash to a PO box in Colombia. That's kind of how it all started. It's a fantastic story. I recommend your listeners look it up online. It has a great ending too, which I won't spoil. Worthy of its own movie, I think. But it's been developing since then, since the 80s. And it used to be very much focused on individuals. So it would go after your PC with your office documents, your photos, your music, all that kind of thing, and ask for a relatively low ransom, $50, $60. Criminals realized that if they could begin attacking businesses and go for a much bigger bang for the buck, they would need fewer infections and they could ask for much bigger ransoms in the order of millions of dollars per victim. And then they built up this affiliate model as well. It's really been growing ever since. It's been growing in the amount of money that it makes. It's been growing in the amount of enterprise victims that are targeted. And what's really critical for me is that it's growing and evolving in tactics as well. And this is really important for businesses to consider. Up until now, the most effective response to being hit by ransomware in your organization has been to have good backups and recover from your backups, right? Your data is encrypted. What am I going to do? I've got backups. That's good. I might lose a day's data. I might lose an hour's data, but I'm going to restore from backups. I'll be okay. Criminals realize this now, and they've moved to something called hack and leak instead of encryption. So they may not do the encryption at all now. They may just break in, steal all of your data, and then contact you and say, hey, we've got all of your data. And if you don't pay this ransom, we're going to release all of your data. And in that situation, what are your backups worth? You have nothing to back up. Nothing has been encrypted. You're not missing anything. Your data has been stolen, but it's also still there. So you've got nothing to recover. So really businesses need to think now that it's not just about, I've got my backups, I'm okay. They need to do much greater work on segmenting networks, making sure that it's not this flat structure within an organization that makes it easy for an attacker to simply travel through the organization, collecting data of interest and stealing it. They need to make their data very difficult to get to and very difficult to get out because it is growing and it will continue to grow because it's so simple.
Okay, there's a couple of things in there. You mentioned before that, you know, I've got backups, I'm okay. Would you say that people are still sort of defaulting to that, like, as an answer, like, oh, I've got the backups, I'm fine. But yeah. For all the reasons you just mentioned,
there's
a bigger problem, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, we're moving away from encryption and denial of access to data to the threat of leakage of data. So a threat to the confidentiality of data rather than access to data. Segmentation of networks is really important. The other thing that I think is really under-deployed, particularly in enterprises, actually, no, enterprises and at home, is encryption. Data is not encrypted, either data at rest, like on a hard drive somewhere or in a cloud somewhere. Data in transit is usually encrypted, hopefully these days, but not within an enterprise. And data in use is never encrypted. Those technologies exist. They're out there. But I think people still have this fear of encryption, A, that it might be too complex to manage, too big a management overhead, but also there's a fear of, if I've encrypted something, what happens if I can't get it back? The kind of the same ransomware fear, but denial of servicing yourself by encrypting your own data. So we have a lot of emotional work to do, but those are really your greatest tools against ransomware now. Obviously, you shouldn't abandon having backups. Backups are great for any number of purposes, but they shouldn't now be your primary or only weapon against ransomware.
So when you said before, in terms of encryption, like, oh no, we can't get it back, what are they fearful of? They can't unencrypt it?
Yeah, I mean, so it used to be the case. Many years ago, I worked for a company called PGP, which is a very well-known encryption solution that's passed through the hands of many different companies over time. Started out as open source, pretty good privacy is what PGP stands for. And I know that people were okay using encryption on something ephemeral, like a network connection. So like a VPN, people get that. They understand that, hey, I'm opening this encrypted tunnel from point A to point B. While I'm using it, everything is encrypted and nobody can listen in. But when I hang up the connection, the tunnel disappears. The encryption also was ephemeral and it's gone away. But I think there's more of a concern, like if I encrypt my emails, let's take a really simple example. What happens if I forget my passphrase to the key? What happens if I lose the key, the decryption key? Will I never have access to my emails again? And actually the answer, if you do things like lose the private key, if it's key pair encryption, or if you forget your passphrase, the answer is, yeah, you do lose access to your data. So within an enterprise scenario, you need to make sure that it is enterprise-ready encryption that is fully managed, that also integrates itself with your backup infrastructure, that you keep the key and the data separate, that you keep the key secured and so on. But this is all, you know, very well-known, very established methodology around encryption. Nevertheless, there is still those emotional barriers to overcome, particularly for smaller businesses where that expertise is not in-house.
Yeah, when you put it like that, that does make sense. And I can understand, like, from a consumer lens, if I put that hat on for a second, how people would be fearful of that. Have you ever had any case where someone's called you and said, like, ugh, kind of lost the key to that? Like, have you been on the front line of that actually happening?
Yeah, my initial career was on the front line of everything. When I started in this business, I started in technical support and I did it for about a decade. So I was the guy that picked up the phone and said, hi, Rick speaking, how can I help you? And that's really where I learned everything. It was the best possible place to be to learn, because the only thing that you see all day, every day is broken stuff that doesn't work. And it's your job to find out why it broke or why it doesn't work and what you need to do to put it back together again. It's that hacker mindset again, right? It's exactly kind of what I said at the beginning of the podcast. And yes, some of those calls were from people that are like, okay, I've forgotten my passphrase or I've lost my key. How do I recover my data? Fully assuming that that was a reasonable question. But of course it's not.
Well, you don't. Wow. And then I guess you had to understand and manage like their emotional response to that, right? And then they're having to explain it to their business.
Yeah, tech support is definitely one of those areas where you learn a lot of emotional intelligence and a lot of empathy. You have to get very good at talking people down off the ledge. One of the very early skills I learned that served me well in the rest of my life was taught to me in my very first help desk job when I was literally tier one support. And it was about matching the tone and speed of the person that you were talking to. So if the person you're speaking to, and this is actually a social engineering skill, if the person you're speaking to is quite quiet and speaks relatively slowly, then if you come in you know, full of energy, speaking fast and trying to you know, get them enthusiastic about something, you're going to fail. You need to be speaking on the same level with the same pace and the same emotion as the person you're speaking to. And equally, if they're speaking strongly and rapidly because they're angry about something, you need to be sounding confident that you know what you're doing and that you're at the same volume and the same pitch and pace as the person you're talking to, so that they have the confidence in you to talk them down off the ledge. So there's a lot of social and emotional skills in tech support. That's the stuff I learned before I learned any of the technical stuff.
Gosh, yeah, that's a tough position to be in. But I guess, you know, it's given you a lot of insight for having that understanding on the customer side then as well, which I think maybe some people don't always necessarily see on the front line. So I think that's really interesting. So I want to go back to, okay, we mentioned before, like, would you say that some people just born into, like, these criminal gangs, or like, how does that sort of work?
I wouldn't say that you're born into it. I don't think anybody's really born into anything. I think it takes a lot of credit for free will and decision making away from people. There are certainly circumstances that will make it more likely to drive you into it. So if you're surrounded by people who have got their fast cars and made a whole bunch of money from being involved in cybercrime and haven't been arrested, then you're going to say, "Wow, this is a pretty simple way and a relatively risk-free way to make money." And I think that's one of the greatest challenges has been historically for law enforcement. And, you know, I've been a security advisor to Europol's Internet Security Advisory Group basically since it was founded. And it's clear, you know, the challenges to law enforcement are clear. It's twofold, really, I suppose. The primary challenges are twofold. One is that attribution in online crime is really, really difficult. It's really problematic. You might be able to say with a certain degree of confidence, geographically, the attack originated in this country. You may even be able to say the attack originated from this autonomous system, this network. You might be able to say from code analysis, that there are enough flags in the code to say, hey, this was written in this country. You might be able from TTPs, the way that criminals operate, to say, oh, this originates from this country because they only do it during business hours, so it's in this time zone. There are a lot of clues that you can follow, but they still really only lead you to a geography. They don't lead you to being able to say whose fingers were on the keyboard, which is challenge number one, and challenge number two, who was directing those fingers that were on the keyboard? Because if you want effective arrests, they need to be people up at the top of the tree. So attribution is really, really hard and really problematic for finding criminals. Not to say it hasn't been done. It has been done successfully, but it is very problematic. And the second thing is, even if you're successful in that, cooperation with some countries is extremely, I was going to say more problematic than others, but it's not, it's extremely difficult. So if you're looking for law enforcement cooperation in the realm of cyber with a country like Russia, particularly now, I mean, now it's basically impossible. But even before the invasion of Ukraine, it was extremely difficult. Same with China, and there are others around the world. You know, for example, I remember when there was a guy that was arrested, a Russian criminal that was arrested in Russia. He was responsible at the time for something called the Black Hole Exploit Kit, which was a really popular, really widespread cyber criminal tool. I got a call from Europol, from a law enforcement colleague in the UK to let me know that hey, we think this guy's been arrested. So I called Europol, my contacts there, and said, is this true? And Europol said, well, to be honest, we're not sure. We hope so, but we're not really sure, and it's difficult to find out. And then there was no further record of any activity in Russia against this guy called Paunch, because what often happens, particularly in Russia, is that when criminals are arrested, they will be given an ultimatum that says, okay, you can go through due legal process or you can come work for us, because the FSB and the GRU in Russia are extremely cyber connected and have a lot of expertise when it comes to both hacktivist intelligence influence operations, attacks, kind of changing people's minds and the way people think with online troll armies and things, but also with attacks on critical infrastructure and development of malicious software tools. So you know, you may not find yourself in your criminal career anymore, but you may find yourself with a law, FSB or GRU type career in Russia.
Okay, I want to press on that a little bit more. So I interviewed Jake Moore. He's in the UK. He's the global cybersecurity advisor for ESET, and he was ex-law enforcement. And we spoke around, like, you know, when these crimes happen, like, do people get caught? If so, what's the percentage? Like, what happens to them? And basically, he sort of said, like, 2% of people get caught, and of those 2% of people, it's really hard to prosecute them. So it's so interesting because you sort of echoed the same sort of sentiments, because it is hard. And if, you know, for example, if I commit a crime in a country and then, you know, there's no treaties in place, it's very hard then to get that person that committed the crime to go back to that country to prosecute them, to even find them. That's what's, I think, complicating it then even more. And then what he was sort of saying is that, okay, well, like, what if we do find them? Like, it's really then hard to be like, okay, well, where are your fingerprints on this, you know, this whole scenario? And then how do we prosecute against that? It's very, very hard, which then I guess concerns me, because then it means that people are going to get away with things with just a slap on the wrist. Like, for example, if I go outside, and I think I've used this example before, if I go and punch someone, like, it's obvious that I've punched someone and then my fingerprints are there and someone's probably seen it in terms of, you know, someone nearby, or it's on CCTV. But in this cyber world, like, if I commit a crime and then just go to a country where there's no treaties in place, like, no one's going to come looking for me. Would you say that worries you a little bit, Rick?
Yeah, if you look at who gets arrested, then it tends to be the people at the bottom of the operation, the money mules, for example, that we were talking about before, the people who are less careful around their operational security. They leave more traces online. They're easy to track. They tend to be in countries where there is cooperation between law enforcement, because it's a, you know, the money mule is a distributed network. You may see warrants for the arrest of senior people within criminal organizations, but it's extremely rare that those warrants progress beyond anything other than a piece of paper. The arrests do tend to be at the bottom of the tree. There have been some very successful operations carried out with multi-agency support, coordinated by Europol and the FBI. So we've seen entire operations dismantled, but they are very much more the exception than the rule. And where we see the greatest success in terms of law enforcement operations still is against infrastructure rather than people, which doesn't solve the problem. So you'll see a whole load of cyber criminal infrastructure being taken down or taken over by law enforcement. You'll see a lot of stories, for example, about the FBI seizing criminal marketplaces, for example. Obviously, that gives them a lot of access to some great intelligence, which is really helpful. But what they've initially only done is gone after the infrastructure. And there have been many, many operations that, you know, take out cloud infrastructure or servers that are being used in the commission or perpetration of cybercrime. But it still doesn't go after the individuals concerned. And again, ransomware is a great example of that. We see ransomware groups like, for example, DarkSide and Conti. They're both great examples. So DarkSide is the ransomware group that was responsible for the attack on Colonial Pipeline that really woke up the US administration. And they realized that they had got far too much publicity, far too many eyes on them. So they disintegrated and splintered and went underground and slowly resurfaced in other ransomware groups. And they're still there. The same thing was true of Conti. Conti got to the point where they were effectively holding the government of Costa Rica to ransom. They, you know, they'd reached that point where they were threatening an entire nation, and realized that, you know, it was too hot in the kitchen, so they had to get out. So they got out, and again, they've resurfaced in a whole bunch of other ransomware operations with different names and taken all of their expertise and contacts with them. So if we're not arresting the kingpins, the people behind these operations, then experience shows us that they will only resurface, re-recruit, and reoffend.
So with the kingpins, do you think there will be, like, in the future, these people up the tree will be sort of getting caught, arrested, being prosecuted? Or, and I don't try to be optimistic or pessimistic, I'm just genuinely curious, like, because, like you mentioned before, like, they're holding, like, a whole country at ransom, or critical infrastructure like the Colonial Pipeline, for example. So do you think we'll start to see that happening, or probably not?
I don't think it will get in the foreseeable future, I don't think it will get any more common than it is now. It does happen. It's extremely rare. And it's usually a failure in operational security on the criminal's part. So, for example, law enforcement might be monitoring chat logs in a private chat that they've managed to get access to because they took over a forum, for example. And they might notice that somebody that they're very interested in is about to go on holiday and they're going to fly through Dubai to get there. And they'll be waiting at Dubai airport and the arrest will happen. That's that example I've just given you is like 70%, 80% couched in reality. I just can't tell you what case it is. So that kind of stuff absolutely happens. But I think the way that the world has turned over the last couple of years, it's become more fragmented and more tribal as a result of the invasion of Ukraine. You know, relations with Russia obviously have been set back decades. China is very much, at least emotionally, on the side of Russia and have become more confrontational and more isolated as a result of that. So we will go back to the Wild West days of the 90s, just after communism collapsed in Russia, where criminal activity wasn't just tolerated, it was encouraged, as long as it wasn't criminal activity against Russian citizens in Russia, which will lead to significantly fewer successful enforcement operations because there'll be no local cooperation on the ground, and significantly more temptation for Russians to be involved in cybercrime because it will go back to being an unpunished and even vaguely encouraged crime.
Wow. So basically what you're saying is if you're committing the crime, like in Russia, you're okay as long as it's not against them. So it's like double standards, basically. Commit the crime, it's encouraged, but as long as it's not against us.
Yeah, I mean, that was always the case. You would look back through the history of online crime and even the way that specific malware was coded. It was coded to look for, hey, is this system using a Russian keyboard layout? If it is, terminate, don't infect. Little things like that. It was just people taking care of themselves, making sure that they weren't going to find Russian law enforcement breathing down their necks. So they would make sure that, you know, if it was a Belarusian system, a Russian system, or any of those Commonwealth of Independent States, as they were called post-communism, that it would simply terminate and not have any effects. So, but what we're looking at now is a world where that methodology, as a result of the current sort of very slow collapse of Russia, I think we're seeing right now, we'll go back to that lawless Wild West 90s Russia, but with the expertise of, you know, nearly 30 years of cybercrime added on top.
So what do you think we do about it?
Well, certainly my whole career has been in building a better mousetrap, and we absolutely need to make sure that we don't lose sight of the capabilities and possibilities that are open to us as defenders, the tools and technologies that are at our disposal. Definitely, like I said, the tools, the solutions are one aspect of that. And if I look at the timeline and the history of how security vendors have been iterating and improving on the security that's offered, it's a positive story. But an equally, possibly more important aspect of that is that we engage with security practitioners and even over and above that, business people within organizations to keep them abreast of what the threat landscape looks like. How do criminals operate? What is the MO? What are the tools? What does it look like when you get affected? What are your mitigations that you should have in place before that? But also, and this has been a part of my career, with one or possibly even both eyes very much on the future, we need to make sure that we're understanding not just the future of cybercrime, or not only the future of cybercrime, but the future of society and technology, because they're all very much interlinked. How is technology changing? How is the way that businesses do business online changing? How is the financial system changing? What does cryptocurrency mean? What's the future of cryptocurrency? How do we interact so as social animals, one with another and one business to another? Because all of those different things will present new opportunities to cyber criminals that they will take advantage of as soon as they possibly can. So we need to make sure that we don't focus solely on our niche. You know, we're not a hedgehog. We don't just have this one skill that we get very good at. We need to focus much more broadly than that on all of those different changes and what opportunities will be presented to cyber criminals so we can build the solutions and the mitigations and have the really important educational conversations before it becomes a problem. Cybercrime is never going to go away because crime is never going to go away. It's just another aspect of global crime. And the more that we as organizations and individuals are connected and digitally enabled, the more opportunities will present themselves for digital crime.
That's excellent. So just to wind up our interview, Rick, I'm curious just on the mousetrap comment saying they're building a better mousetrap. Would you say that we are as an industry as a whole? Now, I ask this because sometimes, you know, the people that I interview on this show for years now, it feels like sometimes we take a step forward in the industry and then something else will happen and then we take two steps back. So it's kind of hard to maybe see whether I think we are, but then sometimes it doesn't feel like that depending on the day, depending on the breach or depending on, I don't know, this ransomware gang that have held a whole country, you know, ransom, for example. So it's always hard to tell.
Yeah, I totally get what you're saying. And I think it's a very subjective experience. Like the day that you get turned over, that's going to be the day when you feel like, wow, we haven't made any progress at all. Or the day when your neighbor gets turned over, that's when you think, oh, come on, this shouldn't have happened. But very often they're right. It shouldn't have happened. And the reason it's successful is that things like security best practices were not being followed. The right technology was not deployed in the right way. The right processes were not in place within a business. You know, disaster recovery or incident response processes were not there. And it sounds a little bit like victim blaming. It's not. What I'm not doing is victim blaming. What I'm saying is that we still have this big educational job to do as well. We can't just rely on the mousetrap. People have to know how strong the spring is, what kind of cheese they should use, where they should put the mousetrap. And none of that is about the mousetrap itself. It's about this educational effort surrounding it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think anything that you've probably been following the news here in Australia, like we've had two massive high-profile breaches and then ASIC have said, oh, we're going to crack down. And then like another breach happens like a few weeks ago. So it's like, oh, we kind of haven't really learned a lesson. But again, it's not a flick of a switch. It's not as easy to just go, okay, we're fine now. We've got the backups. Like there's a little bit more involved in it. But I think we are moving the needle. But again, it's having people like yourself on the show to spread that awareness, to get insight from people, to learn from people who have been in the field for quite a substantial amount of time and to share your insight. So, Rick, it's been absolutely a pleasure to have you on the show. Like I said, I am a big fan of you, so I've really enjoyed today's discussion and you've given some really unique insights that I think it will really resonate with a lot of people listening to this interview. So thanks again for your time and I really genuinely appreciate it.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you found today's episode useful and you took away a few key points. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get our latest episodes.
This podcast is brought to you by MercSec, the specialists in security, search, and recruitment solutions. Visit MercSec.com to connect today.
If you'd like to find out how KBI can help grow your cyber business, then please head over to kbi.digital.
This podcast was brought to you by KBI.media, the voice of cyber.